başka hiç kimse yok içimde, kimse yok içimde.
Aynı lavaki binden dursun istersin seneler.
ağzın ürgü, dumanın tütmez. Kıratım acemi, konağı tutmaz. Kıratım acemi, konağı tutmaz. Oğlun da pek küçük, yerini tutmaz. Oğlun da pek küçük, yerini tutmaz. Cemalım, cemalım, algın cemalım. Alkanlar içinde kaldın cemalım.
to the bank. I've been in the cooking, so I really love straight. My lady want me to move back to LA. She said, lucky I'm proud of you. My bitch like, nigga, don't even say thanks. I don't even let a bitch post my web. Flew to the right, she said, y'all look crazy. She said, lucky it's two of you. It was lucky we was open, it's lucky I have a drink. Fun of me and Benny behind the truck all week. Waiting for a rapper trying to snatch his chain. She said, lucky I'm tired of you. Why every song you been saying my name? Why your fans keep tagging the pics? You drive for that shit and drive me insane. She said, lucky I'm proud of you. She gon' screenshot the shit if I just say thanks. My little brother watch your hoe in a chase. Shorty used to hoop and the shit he was ranked. She say it's too early for yurks. How you getting high, nigga? You ain't even eight. Fucking all the hoes all through Prey Shores. Low end bitch won't stay 48. She got attitude cause another high speed. She just wanna show Instagram her play. Bought a Cartier, now she thinks she from the D. Fuck a Corvette, leave that shit up in the A. A friend thought my brother was a trick cause of me. Mexico up him a bitch like you from the Bay. She said lucky I lied to you, but then you do too, so the shit okay. Broke my heart, so I went to the bank. I believe a cricket, so I really like straight. My label want me to move back to LA. She said, lucky I'm proud of you. She said, lucky I'm proud of you. Broke my heart, so I went to the bank. Broke my heart, so I went to the bank. We'll be right back.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
The ultimate political goal at the heart of our age is the idea of individual freedom.
I believe that freedom is the future of all humanity.
In Britain, our government has set out to create a revolution that will free individuals from the control of old elites and bureaucracies. A new world where we are free to choose our lives, not be trapped by class or income into predestined roles.
To liberate Britain from all the old class divisions, old structures, old prejudices.
To liberate the individual.
And abroad, in Iraq and Afghanistan, Britain and America have set out to liberate individuals from tyranny. For those leading it, it is just a first step in a global revolution for democracy. But if one steps back and looks at what has resulted, it is a very strange kind of freedom. The attempt to liberate people from the dead hand of bureaucracy has led to the rise of a new and increasingly controlling system of management, driven by targets and numbers. While governments committed to creating freedom of choice in all areas have actually presided over a rise of inequalities and a dramatic collapse in social mobility. The consequence has been a return of the power of class and privilege. And abroad, the attempt to create democracy has led not just to bloody mayhem, but a rejection of the American-led campaign to bring freedom.
We're here for your fucking freedom! So back up right now!
And it has summoned up an anti-democratic, authoritarian Islamism. This, in turn, has helped inspire terrorist attacks in Britain itself. In response, the government has dismantled long-standing laws designed to protect our freedom. This is a series of films about how this strange, paradoxical world came to be created. It begins in the dark and frightening days of the Cold War. And it will show how what we have today is a very narrow and peculiar idea of freedom that was born out of the paranoia of that time. It is based on an image of human beings as selfish, isolated, and suspicious creatures who constantly monitor and strategize against each other. The films will show how politicians and scientists came to believe that this idea of human nature could be the basis of a new type of free society. But what none of them would realize was that within this dark and distrustful vision lay the seeds of a new and revolutionary system of social control. It would use the language of freedom, but in reality, it would come to entrap us and our leaders in a narrow and empty world. At the end of the Second World War, America and American films celebrated not just victory, but what many believed would be the dawning of a new era.
I'm singing a song of freedom.
Back then, freedom meant not just liberation from the Nazis, but also from the economic chaos and uncertainty that had caused the depression of the 1930s. Governments now believed that their role was to manage and control the economy and protect society from the dangerous self-interest at the heart of capitalism. Why can't we?
No longer did we worship at the shrine of no-holds-barred capitalism. No. We had been through the Depression of the 1930s. We had been through World War II. Now we were talking about the need for government to be the major balancing element in the economy. The individual was still important, but government would make sure that we would never slide into a deep depression again.
In the following years, the bureaucracies at the heart of the state grew enormously. Their job was to regulate capitalism for the benefit of everyone. in an age of optimism, there were few who challenged this new vision. But one man on the margins was convinced it would lead to disaster. He was an Austrian aristocrat called Friedrich von Hayek, who had fled the Nazis and now taught at the University of Chicago. Hayek was convinced that the use of politics to plan society was far more dangerous than any problems produced by capitalism, because it inevitably led to tyranny and the end of freedom. The terrible example that Hayek pointed to was the Soviet Union. In their search for a utopia, the Soviet leaders had tried to plan and control everything, but this had led them into tyranny and dictatorship. The same would now inevitably happen to the West, he said. It was on what he called the road to serfdom. The only way of avoiding disaster was to go back into the past, back to a golden age of the free market, where individuals followed their own self-interest and government played little or no role. Out of this would come what Hayek called a self-directing automatic system, a spontaneous order created by millions of people pursuing their own gain.
We will benefit our fellow men most if we are guided solely by the striving for gain. For this purpose, we have to return to an automatic system which brings this about, self-directing automatic system which alone can restore to liberty and prosperity. That is my fundamental conception.
Isn't it a philosophy based essentially on selfishness? What about altruism? Where does that come in?
It doesn't come in.
Hayek's ideas were dismissed by politicians and economists. The notion that one could create social order in a modern complex world simply by unleashing individual self-interest was seen as a failed and discredited idea. But proof that he might be right was about to emerge from the most unlikely of sources, from scientists struggling with the new, terrifying uncertainties of the Cold War. This is the heart of a giant, blast-proof bunker 30 miles north of New York. Built in the late 50s, it housed the largest computer in the world, linked to a system of radars around the world, which constantly watched the Soviet Union. Every second, thousands of pieces of information poured into this room to be analysed for signs of danger. The nuclear strategists who had designed this system knew they were dealing with a completely new type of conflict. Neither side could let it get out of control because of the terrifying consequences. So the strategists wanted to find a way of using the information to anticipate what the Soviets might be about to do. And to do this, they turned to a new idea called game theory. Game theory had been developed as a way of mathematically analysing poker games. It looked at the game as a system where the players are locked together, each trying to work out what the other thinks they will do. From that, game theory showed rationally what the best moves were for each of the players.
This is a type of war that had never been fought before. And of course, as we all know, it would be so devastating that it's almost impossible to consider all of its consequences. They still wanted to say that there was a rational way to approach such a virtual war. And game theory seemed to offer that to them, that you could, in a sense, incorporate your enemy into your own thinking, that you could mathematically understand what your enemy would do to the point where you and your enemy will play the exact same set of strategies.
The Center for Developing Nuclear Strategy was a military think tank called the RAND Corporation. And the strategists at RAND used game theory to create mathematical models that predicted how the Soviets would behave in response to what they saw the Americans doing. Out of this came the fundamental structure of the nuclear age. Hundreds of missiles protected in silos underground, and fleets of bombers in the air 24 hours a day. Just as in a game, they were strategic moves to convince the Soviets that if they attacked, America would always have enough missiles to destroy them in return. And in the rules of this game, fear and self-interest stopped the Russians from attacking, and it created a stable equilibrium called the delicate balance of terror.
Recommending missiles underground, missiles and submarines and all that, was a way of making that much more stable. Sometimes the way I used to explain it is, we're trying very hard to reduce the likelihood of nuclear war by creating powerful incentives for the Russians not to start a nuclear war, because we're trying to give them incentives not to attack, either a nuclear attack or with a conventional attack. Yeah, so incentives are important in that.
Underlying game theory was a dark vision of human beings who are driven only by self-interest, constantly distrustful of those around them. And there was a mathematician at the Rand Corporation who would take this dark vision much further. He set out to show that one could create stability through suspicion and self-interest, not just in the Cold War, but in the whole of human society. He was the mathematical genius, John Nash. Nash was portrayed in the Hollywood film A Beautiful Mind as a tortured hero. In reality, Nash was difficult and spiky. He was notorious at Rand for inventing a series of cruel games. The most famous he called Fuck You, Buddy, in which the only way to win was to ruthlessly betray your game partner. Nash took game theory and tried to apply it to all forms of human interaction. To do this, he made the fundamental assumption that all human behaviour was exactly like that involved in the hostile, competitive world of the nuclear standoff. That human beings constantly watched and monitored each other, and to get what they wanted, they would adjust their strategies to each other. In a series of equations for which he would win the Nobel Prize, Nash showed that a system driven by suspicion and selfishness did not have to lead to chaos. He proved that there could always be a point of equilibrium in which everyone's self-interest was perfectly balanced against each other.
The equilibrium, this equilibrium which is used, is that what I do is perfectly adjusted in relation to what you are doing. And what you're doing, or what any other person is doing, is perfectly adjusted to what I'm doing, or what all other people are doing. They are seeking separate optimization, just like poker players.
Is each player alone?
That's the idea, that they are alone, they're separate. Doing something that is very non-cooperative, but very selfish. And then what all of them do works together, and they're deriving from that there is a payoff to all the players. That is the equilibrium. But it's understood not to be a cooperative ideal.
But the stability, the equilibrium, would only happen if everyone involved behaved selfishly. Because if they cooperated, the result became unpredictable and dangerous. A famous game was developed at Rand to show that in any interaction, selfishness always led to a safer outcome. It was called the Prisoner's Dilemma. There are many versions, but all of them involve two players having to decide whether to trust or to betray each other. Imagine you have stolen the world's most valuable diamond. You have agreed to sell it to a dangerous gangster. He offers to meet you to exchange the diamond for the money. But you think he may kill you. So instead, you tell him you will take it to a remote field and hide it. While at the same time, he must go to another field hundreds of miles away and hide the money. Then you will call him, and each will tell the other the hiding place. But just as you are about to make the call, you realize you could betray him. You keep the diamond, and then you go and get the money, while the gangster searches fruitlessly in an empty field. But at the very same moment, you realize that he is probably thinking the same thing, that he could betray you. You have no way of predicting how the other person will behave. That is the dilemma. But what Nash's equation showed was that the rational choice was always to betray the other person. Because that way, at the worst, you got to keep the diamond. and at the best, you got both the diamond and the money. But if you trusted the other person, you ran the risk of losing everything, because he might betray you. It was called the sucker payoff. What the prisoner's dilemma expressed was the strange logic of the Cold War. The optimum solution, offering to get rid of all your weapons, provided the Russians did the same, could never happen, because you couldn't trust them not to cheat. So instead, you went for stability, created by a balance of dangerous weapons on both sides. And what Nash had done was to turn that into a theory of how the whole of society worked. It had enormous implications for politics, because it proved that one could have a society based on individual freedom that wouldn't degenerate into chaos. But the price of that freedom would mean a world in which everyone would have to be suspicious and distrustful of their fellow human beings.
The Nash equilibrium is important because one of the great fears of politics is that self-interest would lead to utter chaos. And what the Nash equilibrium suggests is that rational pursuit of self-interest, even in the face of implacable, hostile enemies, will lead to a kind of an order in which all players agree upon the strategies that they're playing and that those strategies make sense to them. But at the same time, it's also paranoid because it's the idea of a human being sitting alone in a room being able to totally reconstruct their opponent. Their opponent is totally implacable, totally hostile, and bent on their destruction.
But there was a small problem with Nash's equations. They didn't seem to correlate with how human beings actually behave towards each other in the real world. When the Prisoner's Dilemma game was tested out on the secretaries of the RAND Corporation, none of them played the rational strategy. Instead of betraying each other, they always trusted each other and decided to cooperate. And what no one realised was that John Nash himself was suffering from paranoid schizophrenia. He had delusions in which he believed that those around him who wore red ties were communist spies, and that he was part of a secret organisation that could save the world.
You don't want to admit that you are crazy. You see the other people as crazy,